The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. Its motto is, "Things happen when people start talking." You can find information regarding forums, salons, and tours at cityclubofboise.org. The premier sponsor for the City Club is AARP. Annual sponsors include Northwest Nazarene University, Red Sky, and the Idaho Humanities Council. The moderator for today's forum is Marcia Franklin.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to the City Club of Boise. I'm Marcia Franklin, a founding member of the City Club, and I'll be your moderator today. A welcome as well to those of you listening on KBSX 91.5. A thanks to our forum series sponsors today, Echelon Group, Micron, and Perkins Coie, and to our media partners, Boise State Public Radio, 670 KBOI, and Peppershock Media. Now, Maryland really needs no introduction, I think, to most of you here. She was a longtime City Club board member, in addition to the many, many contributions she made to our community. And she was in particular a supporter of the student scholarships provided by the Landmark Club of City Club. And she'd be delighted that more than 40 students are here from the Boise School District, accompanied by Russ Heller. Students, could you please raise your hands? I encourage you, students, to ask questions along with everyone else, and I know Professor Gill is also pleased that you're here. Marilyn also had the utmost respect for our guest today, Professor Jill Gill. She was always telling me about the latest Osher Institute class she'd attended at which Jill was speaking, or an essay of hers that she'd read. She really thought so highly of her, and she would be thrilled that Professor Gill is running the initiative at Boise State named for her. Really, there aren't enough words to say how delighted she would be for that. In our audience as well is Dean Corey Cook from the School of Public Service at Boise State University, which houses the initiative. And Dean Cook, as you will hear, had the vision for this program and is trying to make it happen. So a little bit more about Dr. Gill. She's a native of Washington State and has a BA in American Studies and English from Whitworth College in Spokane. She left the Pacific Northwest to get her MA and PhD in American Civilization from the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. She taught at the University of Findlay in Ohio for 2 years and then came back to the West, joining the faculty of the Department of History at Boise State University as an assistant professor in 2000. She specializes in 20th century American social, political, racial, and religious history with a research focus on the 1960s. From fall 2015 to spring 2016, she was the interim chair of the History Department and then became co-director of the Center for Idaho History and Politics until this past spring when she took over as the lead on the Schuller Initiative. Gill's book, Embattled Ecumenism.
Thank you.
I can say ecumenical, but ecumenism, that's a new one. Embattled Ecumenism, the National Council of Churches, the Vietnam War, and the Trials of the Protestant Left, explored the anti-Vietnam War efforts of liberal Protestants. She's currently researching a book on racial dynamics in Idaho between blacks and whites. That sounds interesting. Now, our forum today will be a bit different than usual, as you can see. I'll be in conversation with Professor Gill instead of her making a formal presentation, as sometimes happens. But we will still have the question and answer period, and that's a really important part of our event. So please feel free to fill out a card during our conversation, raise your hand, and someone will bring it to me. So first, Jill, I want to start by talking about Maryland, because that's why we're here today. You are running the Maryland Schuller Human Rights Initiative at Boise State University, named in her honor because of a generous donation that she also made to this school. But what I want to know first is how you met Maryland. Do you have any recollection of that?
Yeah.
I met her through the Anne Frank Human Rights Memorial. It was just being built when I came to Boise. And I joined the Ada County Human Rights Task Force, which was one of many human rights task forces around the state. And they were involved with that memorial. And so I just became one of the volunteer hands that helped get the celebration going when it first opened. But Marilyn was one of the founders of that memorial.
So what was your sense of her over the years?
Well, she was obviously a human rights icon, an activist, and a mentor to all of us. But what she came to mean for me is that she was sort of the trunk on the social justice activist tree. She was part of the trunk. And if you think of all the zillions of social justice issues that are out there that demand our attention, food insecurity, refugee studies, homeless issues, issues of race, gender equality, sexual orientation issues, add the words, it's so numerous. And we need, and we have many gifted specialists in all those areas, right? But Marilyn understood what made up the trunk, and we went back to her for the sap, for the fuel, and for the understanding of what connects us all. And that goes back to the understanding of sort of what's in the preamble of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is that we are all born with dignity, we are part of a human family, and we all have access, or should have, equal access to freedom, security, and peace. And so she'd bring us back to that. That's the core of what Martin Luther King understood was the beloved community. As activists, if we get, and we need people that can specialize in stuff, because all those issues are so complicated. But the danger, if you don't have the trunk of the tree that is feeding you, that you tap into, it's very easy to get soapboxed on your own thing and to get complacent when you've won what you've won, and also to get competitive for resources and volunteers. We can get bifurcated. And that also then leaves us vulnerable to the most successful tactic that opposition forces use to weaken social justice, and that's divide and conquer. So if we get competitive with each other or one issue gets played off of another, then we can get split. Marilyn never let us get split. And she showed up for everybody. She showed up. And here's a woman who was stricken with polio back in the 30s and 40s when it right around that time, and she was ostracized from school, treated sort of like the way AIDS patients were back in the day. You couldn't go to school, you were seen as some of people didn't want to get around, and it built this great empathy in her. And polio affects you early in your life, and then it comes back to zap you at the end. It weakens your body. And so when she was on her crutches, in her wheelchair, man, she was out there in the snow, on the steps, right, keeping us all accountable and giving us all strength. And so I hope that that part of her, that trunk part of her, is what we bring into the Schuller Initiative and what we bring into Boise State. It's critical.
Thank you. Certainly, and some people remember who are here will remember this, one of the last events that she attended was the Martin Luther King Jr. Human Rights Day at the Capitol Rotunda. Well, I want to give you an opportunity now to talk about what this initiative entails, because it's really multi-pronged. I mean, it encompasses a lot. Yeah. So please, let people know your vision, Dean Cook's vision.
Well, I let me give a shout-out to Dean Cook, because this wouldn't have happened actually without him. Marilyn gave a very generous donation to the school, but without restrictions. And so it was Dean Cook that said, let's take a piece of this and continue Marilyn's work. And so that's my lodestone. And we already have, I have been so impressed by the numerous fronts of social justice work that are happening at the university. I've learned so much by visiting this little mini city that is Boise State and all the many colleges. I mean, we've got nurses that are working on learning how to advocate for healthcare rights. We've got folks in the business college that want to create socially conscious businesses that do good and give back rather than create plutocrats. We've got, obviously, great work in gender studies, multi-ethnic studies, refugee studies, you name it. In every college in the university, there's good stuff happening. So the Schuller Initiative is trying to find its place within that constellation to add a trunk to that tree. And so what we're going to try to do is create a program that can educate people broadly on human rights, help folks learn how to create networks, because we don't get anything done unless we link arms. And that's its own skill. And then learn how to do effective advocacy. Marilyn Schuller called herself an establishment advocate, which meant she worked within the system to find common points of cooperation, even in a tough Idaho legislature. That was her calling. But that's not everybody's calling. And as you find out as a historian, there's a number of different ways to make change. And you've got to find what's the right fit for you and then link arms with folks and appreciate how they do it. The Schuller Initiative is going to try to create a certificate program initially and then hopefully a minor, maybe if we're lucky, fingers crossed, a major. But that can be married to anybody's major. And then the programs we've already got going on that are fantastic will give you the specialization within the field that you need to be able to do good things with. So that's what we're going to try to do. So first, a certificate program at first, and then a minor.
Explain what a certificate program is.
It's a mini minor, and it's the easiest thing we can get started, right? It's a mini minor. It can be 6 to 9 credits. A minor, I think, starts at 12, and it can be any size. And then we can grow from there. We need to get levels of specialty.
So those nurses you talked about,
yeah,
they could get a certificate in human rights
along
with their nursing degree that says, I'm proficient in this area.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Plus, one of the things, we're really good at filling students' heads with data, but we haven't yet really taught folks how to make change. And I think as a historian, I frustrate my students like crazy with some of the history, right? And the challenges that are out there, like race. You know, why haven't we fixed this yet? But we don't often tell students how to then make change and give them those tools. And so hopefully for a nurse that wants to make change on healthcare, we can help them understand how the government works. We can give them some tools and strategies, some resources that they can use, and a little bit of getting their feet wet. And maybe give them a mentor. We're also going to try to have a mentoring program, like Big Brothers Big Sisters, but you have a human rights mentor that will follow you through your career. It's longer than an internship. It's a relationship. And that's the other thing. We want to just give students a foundation. Start building a network of people you can lean on, right? And people that you can watch and people that can guide you. So that's what we're going to do. It's trunk building. It's foundation building.
It's university-wide.
Yes, and
this
that's what
it's going to...
That's what's different about this thing. Most programs live in a department or they live in a college. And again, a shout out to Corey Cook. I don't know if we've ever tried anything quite like this before. Again, Boise State's like a little mini city. We got 25,000 students. We're going to try to build a program that feeds and strengthens, puts a trunk into all the different colleges. So it's housed in his program, but we're going to reach and try to leverage the resources we have across the university.
And it's also for the general community, because I know
yes.
that you already put on an event that had Norm Gissel and Tony Stewart from up north, from Coeur d'Alene,
yes.
speaking to the general community as well. So there will be those opportunities for people who aren't even students
right.
at Boise State.
That's exactly right. And we will do some events, and that was a great one. We thought, geez, we've got white nationalism going from the covert to the overt again in America. Let's grab these two guys that have been fighting the Aryan Nations for the last 25 years and had won awards for it. Let's pick their brains. Let's bring them down. And we use that as a launch event for the Schuller Initiative. But we've also done things like teach-ins, which are open classrooms. Anybody can go. Faculty, staff, students, community members. And we try to grab on to confusing, important, relevant issues today that deal with human rights. And they're almost like a TED Talk. We grab a faculty member and say, 20, 30 minutes, tell us what you think we need to know. Not a bunch of, academia-y stuff, but give us what we need to know to better navigate this issue in the world outside our front door. And then there's about 30 minutes of questions so that you leave feeling empowered with some information on that issue. And so that's open classroom as well.
And cycling back to Marilyn, everyone who's part of this certificate program will have some grounding in who she was as well, yes?
Absolutely. Mentors are critical, and mentors don't have to be alive. She has this body of work, this legacy, these relationships that we'll continue to tap into. And she continues, like I said, to be an inspiration for all of us. And to some extent, the way that she guided her life is again, sort of a lodestone. Yes.
And as I recall, there'll be a core course as well
yes.
that everybody will take
yes.
that you might teach.
I may teach it. We'll see. But yes, a foundation in what human rights are. What's the history of human rights? What flies and what dies? What's gotten in the way of them? It's a bigger story. And we want to lay the specific work that students do against the backdrop of what's gone on in Idaho, what's gone on in America, and what's gone on globally, right? So that you can know that you're part of this bigger effort.
And I know that this is still in flux, but when do you anticipate this beginning?
I think the certificate part of it most likely now will be fall of 2019 because we're building a certificate that bridges our university. And so there's a lot of information that I need to gather and pieces I need to put into place. That'll take a little longer, but the teach-ins are already rocking and rolling. We're also going to have a resource page that will be a one-stop shop that will let people know where human rights research is happening at Boise State University, who's doing the research, what kind of classes deal with human rights topics, where can you find them. Even if you're not in our certificate program, you can take one of our classes. We'll try to link up with OSHER. Volunteer opportunities, opportunities where students are have internship possibilities, or it just if an issue pops up and students want to rally folks together around a particular thing, hopefully we can use our website as a place to, again, bring people together.
Basically, Professor Gill is not going to sleep. No, it's
good work.
Exciting.
Good work.
Well, let's move on and talk a little bit about not just the what, but the why.
Yeah.
You addressed a little bit of this in your opening comments about Maryland in terms of the needing a trunk of a tree,
yeah,
and not just the branches.
That's right.
But let's talk about issues as well. Why do you think that this is important, relevant, critical for students to be able to access in this day and age?
We're in a unique and disturbing time, and it's an urgent time. And let me speak as a historian, okay, for a minute. When I step back into U.S. history, and I particularly look at race, and actually if you want to read an interesting book that deals with, the book called Stamped from the Beginning that won the National Book Award in 2016.
Again, what is it?
Yes, Stamped from the Beginning.
Stamped from the Beginning.
Yes, it won the National Book Award for nonfiction in 2016. It deals with a thesis, it presents a thesis that I've seen in U.S. history, which is we've always from our inception had a human rights thrust in American life. It's part of that creed that Martin Luther King kept calling us back to. It's in the preamble of the Declaration of Independence, right? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women, people, are created equal. They're endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, right, you can't take away. And among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's there. But at the same time, and in our Constitution, we've got, you know, civil liberties lined out. There's that vision, and that always has been within American life. But equally next to it has always been an equally large, equally innovative, and tenacious thrust to block those things. If you look in the Declaration of Independence, they call Native people the merciless Indian savages. If you look at in the Constitution, it protected slavery. And these forces bounce up against each other as a yin-yang, forward thrust, backlash, in a way that doesn't necessarily mean we're always moving in a progressive line. That backlash force is hugely powerful, and we've often misviewed it or misseen it because we say, oh, it's about fear, we can educate it away. It's about people not understanding that we're all the same. That's a wee part of it. But what has driven it from the very beginning is greed, it's a lust for power, okay? And it's about exploitation. It's about a tribalism and breaking us into those parts because certain people can win in that environment. That's why it's so tenacious. When you're dealing with greed, when you're dealing with power, I mean, there's a reason why all the great religions throughout humankind in their scriptures say that greed is the single biggest sin because it does connect to power. It's not easily knocked off. You don't knock it off by education alone. You've got to continually fight it in every generation. So now we've gone forward a little bit, but this backlash is back. And if you study history, you see these commonalities, these certain looks and faces that it has that is seen in Donald Trump and what's going on today. And let me say that there are times in our history when we inherit our democracy. It's running on the railroad tracks just fine, and we just hop on the train, you know, we just ride it down the train. And that's where we've been the last 40 years. Then there's times in history when you're called to rededicate yourself and reclaim your democracy. The tracks disappear. The train jumps the tracks. People are dying and falling out, and you've got to pick that train back up and hopefully build it bigger, stronger, faster. This generation has got to get to work on that now. Every one of us has to get to work on that right now. And if I take Steve Bannon at his words, when he was successful in electing our current president, he said with a wry grin, "We can destroy in 6 months, but it'll take generations to rebuild." So what we need today are builders. builders of the democracy, rebuilders, reclaimers of our of the human rights vision. Okay? And that takes a lot. And it's not only an understanding of human rights, but it's an understanding of democracy. They go together. There's a reason why the UN pushes democracy. Democracy is not perfect, but it's the best structure for human rights philosophies and orientations to thrive. And then democracy needs human rights to be its lodestone. They live or they die together. They live or they die together. So this program is to prepare students for that work. They got to get busy. And young people can do great things. If you look at the civil rights movement, the vast majority of those people were young. Martin Luther King was killed when he was 39 years old. Malcolm X was only 39. They never got to middle age. Most of those students that integrated the schools and that marched and protested were from junior high up through college and, you know, into their early 30s. So you can do big things, but you've got to link together and be ready. Martin Luther King was a person who got himself ready at the university level. That's what we're going to try to do.
So I'm going to start winding in a few questions along with my own. And this question is one that I had for you as well. Human rights isn't left or right, Democrat versus Republican. This questioner wants to know, what will you do to reach out to include conservative students and citizens, since this is Idaho, and I would add, as moderator's prerogative, this is America, too.
Absolutely.
And just attaching an addendum, a lot of people look at universities as these liberal bastions that are inculcating our children in a certain direction.
Right. Yeah.
So how will you mediate that? Because for some people, you know, human rights is... there should be no abortions.
Right.
And it is a human right to be born.
That's right.
So how will you mediate all that?
That's critically important. And I think the abortion issue is a really good one. I think when you teach human rights, the foundation is this respect that we're all part of this human family. That refugee baby is my baby. You have to see it, you know, that kind of way. That can be a foundation in anybody's sort of political perspective. And so, yeah, there can be, and I think what we'll do is have debates over what human rights are. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights gives us a great foundation to begin with. That's when, back in 1948, all around the globe, people came together to talk about what human rights could be, and it was a document that was written by the East and the West. You want to talk about a diversity, a marketplace of ideas. You have in there the political rights of the West, but you have the cultural, economic, and social rights that come out of the East. You had capitalists and communists in there, right? And other forms of conservatives that are trying to decide what this document was. That's the start of the conversation, but it continues. So your example, yes, you can make a human rights argument, a very legitimate one, that it begins at the time of conception, right? And you can make one that it should be focused more on the life and choice and the health of the mother. You can have that debate. That's really important. It makes us stronger when we think through those things and nuance those things and find common points of respect. Two people that understand and respect the idea that human beings have dignity and worth from birth can have that conversation. They can have that conversation in a functional and effective way without ripping each other apart and seeing each other on opposite teams. So we need that. We're stronger when we have a marketplace of ideas. And let me remind you, too, that some of the strongest advocates for human rights in Idaho have been Republicans. Phil Batt, right? A very conservative lobbyist named Skip Smizer. He and I don't agree on much, but he was one of the people, and I know this because of my research behind the scenes, that was pushing hard for Martin Luther King Day for the right reasons, right? Bill Roden, another Republican who's worked with the tribes and is a lobbyist. So we're stronger when we're better in having these conversations. It gets dangerous when we come into tribes. And let me give you an example, too. The left can get completely off whack, too. You know, Steve Bannon is bragging about trying to smash the system. I just taught a course in the 1960s at Boise State, and we just looked at the Weathermen, who were a far left group, right? And they bragged about turning their bodies, turning themselves into a brick and hurling it at the system, right? That's kind of unproductive. So we can both get, right, a little extreme. We need each other. But the foundation can inform a whole range of political perspectives, and I think we're stronger for having those dialogues and including each other. We really do need each other.
What is the best way, then, to have a conservative student or faculty member or community member feel comfortable that this program will do that? How do you think? you'll reach out in that way.
Well, I think respect for the human family, love of freedom, love of concern and care that people have security and peace. Again, that those are compelling parts of not only a global vision, but the American vision.
Maybe we can bring you speakers of diverse.
Absolutely. We can bring in. Exactly. Yes, they can speak to those issues.
I know Marilyn, she wanted to be immersed in ideas, no matter where they were coming from. And this questioner says, one of the traits I most admired about Marilyn was her ability to remain calm and grounded when dealing with opposition. Yeah. Will the initiative teach these types of techniques as a way to continue her legacy of being an advocate for human rights?
Yes, absolutely. And there were four women that came together when Corey Cook said, let's see if we can take a piece of her gift and continue her work. Marsha Franklin was one of the four, Sheree Buckner Webb, who's also a part of the trunk of the tree, and we need folks like you. And then we've got Pam Parks and Leslie Goddard, who are, She talks about having a charge to keep, and that's that part of that trunk. Pam Parks and Leslie Goddard worked with Marilyn. They were successive leaders of the Idaho Human Rights Commission. They knew her well. They've done the work. You guys were in the trenches. And so together at Elmer's over pancakes, brainstormed in 90 minutes this brilliant list of learning objectives. And one of them was exactly what you've talked about. You've got to practice getting in someone else's shoes, be able to empathize with someone who is different from yourself, be able to articulate their perspective, even if you completely disagree with it, articulate it, understand it from the inside, and then able to talk with it and find those points of intersection. So we will have, and they help brainstorm some exercises that students can do to learn that, kind of mediation, that kind of calm. Again, you've got to respect somebody that you see in a different kind of position and learn to listen, right, and reflect back and be thoughtful, right? And she showed dignity to everyone. She could go to the State House and talk to someone who was on the way other side and reflect to that person that she respected who they were. And she could almost always leave with some kind of point of intersection, some kind of, at least a hook that she could come back to and develop and nurture. So we will teach that. We'll have students, y'all, if you come into this program, you're going to get an opportunity to role play a little bit of that. Do it for each other, okay?
We have two questions, and I assume they are from students that address that population, that basically touch on the same point, which is how can we offer students in high school opportunities to become more involved in these human rights activist movements? Should we be encouraging activism in schools?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Young people are the conscience of America. It's their future. And again, as a historian, I think back to the history of civil rights and human rights, young people were always involved there. They were the ones that getting sprayed by the fire hoses and bitten by the dogs and made us think about what kind of a authority and power structure we had in America. So young people need to be part of it. With respect to, let me just say for high school students, you guys know who planned the Women's March? That was, those were two high school students. And they put that on their shoulders, had some mentors that helped them. So, yes, absolutely, we need you. I'm not yet sure how Boise State can support it, but that will be something that maybe Russ Heller and I can talk about. Yes, and other folks who are leaders in the high schools, let's meet and talk about how Boise State can help support what you're doing and empower what you're doing. The bigger, stronger, quicker, faster we get started, the better.
Well, and related to that, there's a question here, which I was also interested in, is how can people who aren't students engage in this certificate at Boise State? You mentioned potentially mentorships as being one way.
Absolutely. I look around out at this room, and we have a lot of veterans and specialists in particular fields. And not only that, but folks that know the skill sets that work. And so we would love to bring you in to teach what you do really well. And also, if you're willing to do a mentorship, and that's just putting a young person who's launching themselves on the path of human rights under your wing a little bit so that they can have coffee with you maybe once a month and see you go through the cycle of the work you do. What lifts you up when you need to be lifted up? Where are the victories? Where are the struggles? What kind of perseverance and tenacity does it take? How do you use your network? Where does humility come in? Because we all have to leverage the gifts that we have, but we can't do everything. So how do you reach out and create a network of folks that can buttress you where you're weak, right? They need to see that and then be able to ask you their questions. And then when they leave, maybe they can, you can be someone they can pick up the phone and call when they're having a good day or a bad day. So mentors would be great. Internships would be great. Yes, come to our events too.
And so for the radio audience included, they should contact you if they have,
sure.
if they have a willingness to potentially be
yes.
a mentor.
My email address is jgill@boisestate.edu, jgill@boisestate.edu. Please email me.
Professor, I'm curious to know how one measures the success of a type of program like this, what yeah. the metrics would be, yeah. because I think, you know, universities are increasingly moving that way, businesses, right. to assessing whether they should keep a program.
Right.
How do you envisage deciding or measuring whether this has been successful, yeah. say, 5 or 10 years
yeah. after? It will know it by its fruits. If students can come back and say that they were well prepared with the knowledge and the skills and the ability to navigate the system, right, and to put networks together, if they can come back and find their place and get to work, they come back and say, yeah, you prepared me well, that's what will let us know. And again, I think about, as a historian, I'm always thinking about the past, and I think about Martin Luther King. He was called to lead the Montgomery bus boycott at 25 years old. He was brand new, fresh, baby-faced right out of school. He didn't know that'd be waiting for him. But he knew that he had a charge to keep, too. And he knew he was going to be a minister, and he knew he wanted to do something on social justice to help that cause. So when he was in the university, he wasn't just studying for his vocation. He wasn't just thinking about his job. He was preparing to be a minister. But he read, and he consciously thought about how do you make change. So he read Thoreau's On Civil Disobedience and learned that the only proper place for a just man in an unjust society is in jail. And he thinks about filling the jails, right? He read Reinhold Niebuhr, right? And, you know, where you talk about that you can use a moral argument against with an individual to help transform and change them because they have a heart and they can love. But when you're dealing with a system, love isn't going to do it. You have to organize power. Power doesn't give up power willingly. You have to make it do it. That, he got that from Reinhold Niebuhr. He read the social gospelers and learned about the churches shouldn't just call out personal sins and immoralities, but have to also be courageous enough to call out societal sins and immoralities. If you're against sin, get off from behind your stained glass windows and get out there and march in the streets where Jesus might be, right? He obviously studied Gandhi, Hegel, and he was prepared before he left. He was prepared before he left. He had been thinking about it, wrestling with capitalism and communism and human rights. He'd been chewing on those things. So then when he gets out there and they say, hey, young man, you've got some talent, some skills. Will you lead this movement? And they gave him 20 minutes, only 20 minutes, to prepare his first speech to rally his congregation that was sitting in front of him. He could do it. He could do it. So how do we know it when our students can do that? When they pop out into that world and feel like they can meet that call, we will have done our job.
Do you have a sense, you and Dean Cook, of whether there are any other programs like this, university-wide human rights initiatives
yeah.
at colleges, universities?
I've done some checking around. There's a number of universities that have human rights minors, majors, and institutes. There's one at Yale. There's one at Columbia, University of Chicago, San Francisco, University of San Francisco, Berkeley, Indiana, University of Dayton, there's a number of them. But in our region, not so much. The University of Colorado and University of Denver have some programs. But in our region, not so much. So I think this is a place where we can innovate and provide some resources. And I hope University of Idaho, let's collaborate. Because this isn't about turf. You get turf and you get all divided up. University of Idaho, this is bigger than any university. Okay,
Idaho
we need all young people.
And Idaho State is represented.
Idaho State, let's get together.
Northwest Nazarene is represented.
That's the thing about human rights. You gotta erase the divisions. We need numbers. You change things by numbers. Okay, so let's forget the turf. Okay, we do that on the football field. Let's bond together and work together on this.
And by the way, we're both wearing almost identical blue. This is a total coincidence.
Yes.
We've got the blue turf look going on our outfits here, but that's not, we didn't plan that.
No, we didn't plan it.
Professor, this person wants to know, what human rights issue in Idaho today worries you the most, and what solutions might your initiative help have to help solve this issue?
I can't pick one. They are interconnected and tangled up. It's whatever issue is affecting the person in front of us. They're all big. Poverty, I think, is at the base of so much of it. The gap between the rich and the poor scares me because almost everything else can get connected to that. And let me tell you, friends, when you empty out the middle, people, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? Everybody needs food, clothing, shelter, and safety. And we will sell our bodies, we will sell our souls to be able to get those things. That's because we're living creatures and we can't survive without them. To make sure that we and our kids have those things, we'll do anything, right? Once you have those, then you can start hitting the other things. That's why in the 1960s you had this plethora of revolutions, social justice movements, because we had the best economy in American history coming out of World War II for about 20, 25 years. That empowered people to be able to take to the streets. When you empty out that middle, when you have very rich and then you build poor, you create people who are exploitable. We're willing to give up our rights. We're willing to cut each other off. We're willing to get tribal for our little plate of food, for our little cup of water, right? It makes you vulnerable for exploitation. And then the folks at the top have got the puppet strings. So that scares me. And if you look at what's going on with tax policy and cutting off people's access to higher education, folks, if the kids in here, if their scholarships are going to start getting taxed. You have those types of things that keeps opening up this gap between the rich and the poor. Everything else is going to get harder. So that freaks me out. Second only to that for me, because this is the issue that I care about so much, is America's original sin of race. Okay? If you want to understand how exploitation works and how it's connected to power and greed, just study the history of race in America. That will empower you to understand almost every other type of exploitation that we're dealing with. So that's a good one to get your teeth into. And if you want to understand American history, that's why I studied it. I wouldn't be an American historian with my salt if I didn't start taking myself to school on that one, because it helps explain everything else. But the class thing, that's a scary thing.
So this person says, this is an extreme point, but very current. Should a white nationalist be allowed to speak on a campus to provide an alternative viewpoint if many people feel threatened by those concepts? Free speech versus security.
And that's a fantastic question. We were just dealing with that in my 1960s class, because we studied the free speech movement of the 1960s, and we were looking at that issue. And let me say that when we brought down Tony Stewart and Norm Gissell from North Idaho, they fought the Aryan Nations for 25 years. They've lived with death threats for decades. And Tony Stewart was challenged with that. Actually, Richard Butler, who was the head of the Aryan Nations, he said, because Tony Stewart had a radio show, right, Popcorn Forum. He says, oh, Tony, you would never let me speak on your radio. And he said, well, yes, I would, because he believed in the marketplace of ideas. And so he set up a debate that was on the radio between Richard Butler and the prosecuting attorney for Coeur d'Alene. And he gave Richard Butler 20 minutes, and he gave this guy, and then they did questions for an hour. And he did it because he trusted in the marketplace of ideas. He believed that Richard Butler would expose himself. And it worked in that way. So speaking from a university, and this is the tough thing, because universities are dedicated to diversity, inclusion, and against hate. So on the one hand, that's the value of the university, right? On the other hand, democracies work best if you have a marketplace of ideas, including bad ideas. And sometimes you got to shine a light, right, to find out these other things. So I would say, and I would do it.
But on even less, with even less controversial speakers, we've seen
that's right
violence on campuses.
Right,
and so
it's not an easy dilemma.
It does become a security issue.
It absolutely does become
so
a security
issue.
Maybe it's a higher end. It is a higher decision. It's a volatile thing. Marketplace of ideas is part of what democracy is founded on, and I think, like I said, that's what Thomas Jefferson and others believed, that a bad idea will reveal itself, and if you squelch it out, other people might make it sound like a good idea, right? They can spin it. Best to get your eyes on it. But it's a complicated issue. It is. Security issues and so on. So that's just speaking more from an ideal. But it's tough. And the university still has to stick to its values. It still has to say, yes, this person is speaking, but they don't speak for us. They do not speak for us. We're exposing that out there, but they do not speak for the values of this university. They don't represent the university. The university still operates on these particular principles. But we're not yet.
So I think this is related. This person says, speak to the value of discomfort in the context of the study of human rights.
Yeah.
I mean, I would expand that as well to just a liberal education.
That's right.
You know, the value of being confronted with ideas that are very, very different from your own.
That's exactly right. That's where growth comes from, and that's where you find who you are, right? And that's part of, again, pluralism in all its forms. That creates, I think, the strongest society and the strongest human beings. That's where we're forced to grow when we confront things and have to argue for them and ask questions and process and noodle things and marinate on them. That's what universities are about. That's partly why we're dangerous, right? Because we do that. And you don't often get to do that in other parts of your life. You don't often get to do that within your religious community. Sometimes you don't get to do it around the Thanksgiving dinner table, right? Because there's things that are off limits. Right? Universities are supposed to be places where we can look at anything from an academic perspective, and we have to be courageous in that. But that, like I said, that's what makes us dangerous, too.
I remember one of my favorite interviewees, Professor Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, who's an Idaho native and teaches at Harvard. She said, and she used to be the head of the American Historical Association.
Yes.
And she said, yeah, history can be very dangerous in and of itself, and that's why governments... One of the first things that sometimes a totalitarian government does is to burn the books.
That's right. Control the narrative. History can be extremely politicized, right? We create narratives and stories about ourselves. And right, that's the job of the historian is to pop that open beyond those boundaries and get us to look at ourselves.
This person says, you mentioned that you first met Marilyn during the construction of the Anne Frank Memorial. How do you plan to incorporate the Wasma Center for Human Rights into your new program?
And we've just begun discussions on that. That's going to be a rich opportunity. One of the things that the Wasma Center has asked of the Schuller Initiative is if our students could help be docents and things of that kind of nature and do that kind of service. So, and I know also the Wasma Center works great with high school teachers and helping prepare high school teachers to teach about human rights and social justice within those schools. If there is a way that we could be of service to that, because I think it's really important that we see the high school students, right? We help them move forward, and then it's like passing the baton, right, into the university system. So the Wasma Center can help us on that, connecting with high school.
This person writes, often conversation and compromise leads to policy gridlock in a federal and state level. I think this might be from a student to this point, too, maybe just tweaking it a little bit. Political polarization has created an edge, sometimes a hostile environment, in and between schools, particularly high schools. How can we change our environment to allow for a more open and cooperative dialogue, even at the high school level? Are there tips that you have for teens when they find themselves in these situations where they're passionate about something, but then another group is equally passionate? There are a lot of clubs in high schools now that didn't exist when I was growing up.
That's right.
For an outlet.
Right, and passion is good. Passion is good, but you have to have the listening skill. And I think, again, our media can be a great help. City Club can be a great help. But we get so used to people shouting past each other. That's the image of advocacy. And I think the piece, we've got Brian Pappas on our campus, who's in the School of Public Service, who does mediation. He just did a teach-in for us about persuasive listening. And it took me to school, you know, that you can be passionate about your thing, but you've got to learn how to actively listen, even with who folks are across the board. So I think in high schools, we can't start teaching that too early. It'll not only help you out in the world with issues, it'll help you in your marriage. It'll help you with your friends. It'll help you in all kinds of things. And so that may be one thing that we can do is rather than talking, get that other piece of it and learn how to understand each other. Yeah.
Well, and here's another view. To bring the two parties together, would you have to just completely destroy the curtain system, which is driving us farther apart, and rebuild the political model? You know, as a historian and an activist, how do you see that? I mean, are we at a point now? I mean, certainly the public, whether some of them were for Bernie Sanders or for President Trump, were expressing a desire to get away from the current
system. Right.
So do you see us moving towards kind of a blowing up of the current two-party political system? Two or three?
It's never happened, so as a historian, I live in the past. It's hard for me to envision. And Lord of the Flies is not appealing. I think, I want to go back to...
For high school students, it might be.
Yeah. I think going back to reclaiming, reteaching, re-understanding what our democracy is, and let's take that all the way up to in Congress. All right. What the values
really
are.
We used to have cute things on TV that taught about it. You know, these little
Schoolhouse Rock.
Schoolhouse Rock. Oh, you know, okay. How a bill becomes a law.
No, but I really think we need to go back to square one. Understand what human rights are. Understand these principles of human rights and democracy. Through our whole society, it can be a good catalyst for us. Norm Gissel was talking about that when he was with us. This bad time can become a good thing if we reclaim who we are as a country. That'll make Congress more functional if we look at each other differently and if we understand something bigger and higher than ourselves. The problem is you lose your democracy when you lose a connection to things that are higher than yourself. The rule of law, the fact that there are actual truths and facts out there, that there are visions that we connect to. Otherwise, if you break that up, all you've got are tribes, war against war, tribes bashing against each other. If truth disappears, if values and systems of law and democracy disappear, it's one tribe against the other, and you're just battling for power there. So again, that's what we've got a little bit in Congress. That's what the political parties have come to. So I think we need to reconnect ourselves to these bigger things and have our loyalty connected to those kinds of things. I hope Republicans in Congress will do what they did during the Nixon administration. It was Republicans that helped get voted for impeachment. They said, my loyalty is to the Constitution and not to the man in my party and not to, to Nixon. It's to the fact that, you know, the presidency means something more than Richard Nixon, right? It stands for our democracy. And so that kind of a loyalty, that kind of a patron. The Edward R. Murrow, who stood up to Joseph McCarthy, right?
So you see it in, I mean, so when you, as a professor, make a statement like that, which I think, you know, and I saw some faces when you said that, which is basically, you know, Republicans should stand up and impeach our current president.
Not impeach, but I think the problem is the loyalty that we have. The loyalty has gone to party. You can say that with Democrats, too. That if their loyalty is to the party and not to these higher things, we get tribal. Okay, and that was just a current example because I just taught Watergate in my 60s class. And so we were talking about that.
Seen Democrats call for Conyers and...
That's exactly right. That's right.
From Minnesota.
That's right. Democrats have protected people, too, because they're protecting their tribe. They're protecting their team. You've got to be loyal to some higher principles. And so that was just one example. And I think we have seen... I'm very proud of some of the folks in the parties that disconnect themselves from the party when it is called to do that and remind ourselves who we are as a people. That's kind of what I meant there. Thank you for the clarification.
Sure. For the teachers in the audience, this person says, and part of the radio audience as well, do you know of particular enrichment lessons available to add to the curriculum for
K through 12? I assume the WASMA Center.
A lot. They are the experts at that, and they're going to be taking me to school on that. Hopefully we can support them. But they have done a lot with having professional advancement opportunities for teachers that go across days and weeks at a time. And it's really, really well done. Really well done.
This person wants to know, having grown up in this part of the country, then leaving, going back east for higher education, what most surprised you when you returned? And maybe, and if you want to, you can set it in the context of human rights issues, if you want.
Coming back to the Pacific Northwest after going back to Philadelphia. I grew up in the white suburbs of Seattle. It, like many white people, unconscious of issues of race. It wasn't taught. It wasn't discussed. And then I went and lived in Philadelphia, and I started studying it because it was the world outside my front door. When I came back to the Pacific Northwest, this sort of became a place that I wanted to try to work with respect to that. And Idaho has it has an interesting kind of history with respect to this. In the year 2000, when I arrived here, Idaho had more human rights groups, more human rights organizations than any other state in the Union per capita, and that's because the Aryan Nations had been here, and it was necessity that created it. And the history of Idaho, though, is actually it's been a white flight state from the very beginning. And so what I started to notice when I came back was just because I had it on my radar was the nature of race in the Northwest. And the entire Northwest started off as a white flight destination because it was white. And so that interesting thing has been on my radar ever since, is the dynamic of race in this particular region. And that's why I'm studying black-white dynamics in Idaho, because it's kind of a unique...
Talk about a little bit more about the book that you're researching.
Yeah, it's looking at, it goes back to Idaho's territorial days in the 1870s and looking at the dynamic of race so that we can lay Idaho across the bigger story of civil rights in America. And I do see two threads. They're just like the nation's history, you've got a civil rights thrust, but in Idaho, sadly, and I didn't want to find this, the white flight thrust has always been a little bit bigger here, and it reinforces itself. And so we've had these waves of white flight that have continually come into Idaho and have affected our politics, too. The state that brought the most people into the Northwest, and particularly Idaho, up to 1920, from the 1870s to 1920s, was a slave state, Missouri. And so there were a lot of people that were fleeing the diversity and the Reconstruction and coming up here. We had a large Confederate presence here. We had a large presence of the Ku Klux Klan in the Pacific Northwest that reinforced those kinds of things. Our own Senator William Borah made political common cause with the Deep South to bust anti-lynching legislation. The Republican Party had promised African Americans they'd pass anti-lynching legislation after World War I because so many African American men had been lynched coming back from the war. And it was some Western Republicans that fused with Southern Dixiecrats to kill it, and our own William Borah was part of that. Our state did not support our constituency. Our constituency was against the Civil Rights Act of 1964, even though our very brave congressional delegation of Frank Church and Compton White and Len Jordan, bipartisan, voted in favor of it because they were hearing the debates in D.C. We have been a white flight state after the Watts riot. A lot of people from Southern California came up here to get away from diversity. Historians called the highway between Southern California and Idaho the white flight highway for a while. There were so many U-Hauls going one direction. And then after the Rodney King beatings, another wave came up.
Oh, the blue wave, they call it, with all the police officers.
Yeah. And yes. And so when you look at the history, like again, I'm a historian. When you drop the Aryan Nations story on the backdrop of this, it's part of a larger whole that then reinforces itself. We've now got a group in Northern Idaho called the Redoubt Movement. And there's a, skipping my name now, but there's another group like it that are calling people from the coastal regions who want to keep a homogenous place and to keep politics in a way that will keep homogeny to come to places like Idaho so that they can control and support a particular kind of demographic. So it continues yet again in our own time, even though the Aryan Nations are gone and Richard Butler is dead and buried. This is part of our history. Now, that has also, like I said, always called up human rights activists and have gotten in the trenches. We can do good work here and we need to hang together and so on. But that's part of our history and that shapes the milieu in which our discussions happen. It's important to know your zip code. It's important to know the milieu in which you're doing the work. And that has a particular flavor here. And it's part of the bigger national story. I hope that helps a little bit.
Yeah. Definitely. Okay. This person says Marilyn was a voracious reader. Mm-hmm. As those of you know, after she passed away, we allowed people to come in and have one of her books if they wanted to. She had so many books. What books would you put on a reading list for people who want to learn more about human rights history or activism? Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to put you totally on the spot. If you think of other ones, we can always put them online or whatever. But okay. Are there a couple that come to mind for you?
Yeah. One of the ones that's most fascinating, and it shakes us up a little bit because it gets to the economics of history, economics of race, is a book by Ira Katznelson called When Affirmative Action Was White. That's a provocative title. It was written by, he's a very well-established scholar. He was the president of the American Political Science Association. He's a big dog. And he talks about affirmative action from the New Deal period up through the 1970s, but how the federal government gave benefits to white people for many times that help create a gap between African Americans and people of color. And it helps us focus back on the economics of social justice. We've been taught since the Cold War to look at social justice and race, particularly in terms of feelings, right? We don't like each other, we're afraid, or it's about just respecting diversity, and it can be done away with education. We've got to remind ourselves of the economic roots. The Cold War made it dangerous to talk about the economics of race because you could get red-baited. If you talk about the economics of race, all of a sudden you're a Marxist. And so people started talking about it in a different way. It's about loving each other and kumbaya, which is all very important. But if that's where you stay, you're never going to figure out the root of it. So Katznelson breaks down the government's role in helping create a gap between white and people of color. And that's our time period. That's our generation. That's a good one that will shift how we understand things. Another one just with respect to civil rights in the North. We look so much at the South when we look at civil rights. There's a book called Sweet Land of Liberty by Thomas Sugrue, and he looks at the civil rights movement in all its manifestations across the rest of the country. From the 1920s, it started way before the one in the South, up to today. That's a good one. And then if you just want a really good primer on human rights history globally, because human rights isn't just a Western idea, it crosses the entire world and it goes way, 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 way back. Paul Loren from, I think he worked at the University of Montana, has a book called Human Rights, a Vision and a Reality, something of that. I don't have quite the title there. But just look for his book on human rights, Paul Loren, and it gives you the whole sweep, including up to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
We've only got about a minute and a half, 2 minutes left. Mm-hmm. I think you'll like this question, and you, Dean Cook. How can someone make a financial gift to support this program?
Yeah. Talk to my dean.
Who do we make our checks out?
Yeah, we've got seed money. We've got a little seed money to get this booted. But if it flowers in the way that we hope, we will need some help. It'll just allow us to do a little bit more. So I would ask you to contact the dean's office, and they can work that out with you. Thank you.
I'm going to wrap up with this question, cycling back to Maryland, because I know one of the visions you have for this program is, how do we make a Maryland?
How do we make a Maryland?
And this is a question I assume from a student. Mm-hmm. In this day and age, it's common for young people to feel helpless about the future of our country, the future of the environment, and our personal futures. What do you have to say to young people who are fearful about their next steps?
Right.
Great question.
It is a great question. And that's the $64,000 question. It's, I think, starting to build a, and Marilyn often talked about this, Tony Stewart and Norm Gissell, start to make a network of people who are doing good work, because that gives you hope, right? Don't stay isolated. Don't stay atomized. And take a step. Get with people who are doing good work. Build a network. And when you start to have, they said, a first victory, and even just a network that you can laugh and cry with, people that have abilities and resources that you don't have, and that you can also have your gifts strengthen them, that builds hope. Start at that grassroots level and start to make a difference. And then realize, and I don't want this to sound fluffy, but it really is at the core of everything, go back to the place of love. And the beloved community is what it's all about. When you get back to seeing people with human dignity and respect, when you want a child that you see on television who's in a refugee camp in Greece, if you can love that child and feel for them and want for them what you want for your own, that's the kernel of it. That's what connects us all. The tribalism, the competition is what splits us all up. So take a step toward that. And there's other people out there that are just like you. Lock arms. That's where the hope can grow.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for the radio audience. You've been listening to the City Club of Boise's Forum with Professor Jill Gill of Boise State University on the new Marilyn Schuler Human Rights Initiative at the university. Please join me in thanking Professor Gill. Thank you.
You have been listening to the City Club of Boise, a public forum discussing important issues of the day in a nonpartisan, civil manner. The next City Club event is the 23rd Annual Political Pundits Forum on Tuesday, the 30th of January, and features local journalists and political experts discussing the 2018 Idaho legislative session. Register for that lunch forum, learn about becoming a member, and see a schedule of upcoming events at cityclubofboise.org or by calling 208-371-2221. Connect on Facebook and Twitter by searching for City Club of Boise.